Hey, you are listening to The Workplace Leader. This is the podcast where we go behind the scenes of corporate real estate, talking to industry experts about how they shape the next generation workplace. I'm your host, Sabine M., and in today's episode, I'm speaking with Sheila Botting. Sheila is Principal and President Americas Professional Services at Avis & Young. Hi, everyone. We're back after summer break, and I'm really excited. Today with me is Sheila Botting. We had a really good prep conversation. I was really excited about that and sad again that we hadn't recorded that already, but now we're talking. So hi, Sheila. She's in Toronto, so it's morning for her. Let's start with you telling us a bit about your current role and your professional background.
Great. Thanks so much, Sabine. It's wonderful talking to you this morning and overwhelming when you talk about yourself, right? So my role is I'm currently president of the Americas for Professional Services for Avis & Young. And what that is really Avis & Young, you may know, is the world's fastest growing commercial real estate firm. Over the last decade, it's shown tremendous growth. The next evolution of that growth is really to add professional services, consulting, project management, valuation, technical building services, and so on. So that's my mandate now in North America. I've been with them for a year and a half, and it's been an amazing experience joining Avis in the middle of COVID, as you can imagine. So I'm meeting all kinds of folks across Canada and the US by my laptop screen, which is really, you know, a crazy time to be doing all this, but incredibly rewarding as well.
Now, what have you done before you came to Avis & Young? I know that you've been in different sides of commercial real estate, both occupier and investor.
Sure. So I'll start a little bit on my career. I started as a management consultant with one of the KPMG predecessor firms, then moved to a Brookfield firm that was acquired by Cushman & Wakefield. And then most recently, I was at Deloitte, where I was their Canadian real estate leader and a senior firm. Through those roles, I've really gained a perspective from the investor, asset management valuation. How do you optimize value of an asset? I spent a lot of time in the office building world. And then working more recently with Deloitte, working as an occupier, both in helping them to make their own decisions on their own portfolio and building spaces, and then with some of the largest tenants and clients in the Canadian marketplace. What you learn is that, what is it they say, always form follows function. And so in this case, the function is really what does the business need for its occupancy, for its employees in the war for talent? And sometimes what the business thinks they need is really not what they truly need. And so you have to discover what those true requirements are so that you can then transition that into the physical space, the interiors, and then understand how the building plays a role. And what I've noticed through that continuum is that there's tremendous opportunities because, you know, many folks have taken a very traditional view to, you know, the box of the building through the interiors, yet the way the world is evolving, digital transformation, people transformation, the war for talent, and now that we're in this COVID or post-pandemic environment, a whole other transformation, what you realize is that in partnership together, we can have much better solutions and a much better dialogue toward the experience of the people working in those buildings.
Yeah, I actually like to jump right in on that. You've mentioned you've learned about values of the assets. And I know that recently it's been oftentimes discussed that real estate should be more of a service or offered as a service. Now, while I was a corporate real estate manager, what we offered was oftentimes, especially in the hot markets, like in the central business districts, you usually get shell and core. And that's not really real estate as a service. Where do you see that landlords can change how they view their assets and really create value for the occupiers?
Sure. So there's a whole continuum. So there is the shell and core. And obviously today that shell and core has to be sustainable. It has to meet WELL standards. It has to be current current in today's market. Many buildings are not current, so that's kind of base case. We need to get to that level. So whether you achieve LEED Platinum or net zero, whatever that looks like on the continuum, becomes a really important base case in today's modern world. The notion of collecting rainwater for building plumbing and sewage systems, like you'd think 10 years ago that was rocket science, today that's table stakes. And so how do all of those pieces fit together? So that's kind of step one. Step two then becomes about the interior of the building. And again, if you even focus just on shell and core, things like, you know, the internal stairwells that right now are boring, gray, dreadful, horrible places nobody ever wants to go to. Well, what would happen if you created an employee experience and use those staircases for wellness? So you could go running up and down the stairs during the day and feel more positive about being in the stairwell. I mean, that's just an example. Another example for a landlord would be the building lobby. Typically sterile, lots of marble and glass, and pretty boring for the most part. You know, and people walk through the lobby to get to their elevator and get whisked to their cell in their office. And then you say, well, what if we actually activated that whole lobby experience? Sometimes there's undergrounds or adjacent buildings attached to it. Let's activate that experience so that you want to be in that building. I go to the examples during the pandemic, you know, on the streets, we now have all kinds of outside dining, which is totally been an amazing experience for the downtowns of many cities. And so this is really an extension of that into the building lobbies. And so that could be as simple as a coffee shop, whether it's Starbucks or some other local brand, right through to a full food experiential offering. Then the next part of that is then working with your tenant to say, what does the tenant need in their space? And how do we make sure all of those things are right? So again, I could talk forever on these subjects. So for the tenant, it becomes about now the technology is the building empowered to allow me to do what I need to do. So that could include, you know, IWMS, integrated workplace management systems, where you monitor how many people are coming and going from the building at any given time. So me as a tenant, I want to understand my occupancy of my people in the building. If I have 1,000 employees, before COVID, only 50% of them would show up during the day. And so I'm sitting on 50% vacancy rate in my office space. So as we emerge from the pandemic and the hybrid working models, I need to understand how many people are in and out during the day, who's in and out, maybe even getting into some of the contact tracing elements of that, so that you now are starting to build toward a smart building. That smart building can include the utilization of space, touchless, you know, screens everywhere, and wireless connectivity. Many buildings don't have wireless connectivity for their tenants, fiber, all of those other bundle of technology pieces. So that's on the base building side. Haven't got the tenant side yet, but hopefully that helps to illuminate the conversation.
Definitely. And that's like a lot of things you could already do and think about. And what you just mentioned at the end, I think landlords in the future might have a stake in understanding utilization of their occupiers as well, because it can give them a hint in whether space is still needed or not, and if they need to shape up coming towards a break option or something in the lease. So really, really exciting field. Coming back a little bit, who do you typically work with on the occupier side in your current role?
So obviously the wide range of clients, from very large occupiers, whether they're 100 or 500,000 square foot occupiers, and I'll come to who within that entity, right through to small 5 and 10,000 square foot occupiers. And so the conversation is the same across the board, but how do you scale up and scale down? And so the conversation lies around the employee and customer experience, the war for talent. So who cares about that most? It's at the C-suite, right? It's about the executive level. So typically the programs will have, you know, the most senior executive, sometimes the CEO is actively involved. Human resources, of course, they need to be at the table. Technology, because you're moving toward a digital business, and real estate. So those would be typically the pillars of any kind of workplace program. Now we also layer in ESG, innovation, and some of the other newer elements so that there is totally a group eyeballs, many lens engagement to what the outcome is for that business and that organization. 10 years ago, it would have been the real estate person, you know, slamming together a lease. How much space do we need? Count the number of people. How many square feet per employee? Let's divide a bunch of cells and we're good to go. Now it goes to the experience. And so when we think about the experience, you manage the user journey of your employee. And it's the CEO and the C-suite that really cares about that. It's about the war for talent, attraction, and retention.
Absolutely. Although I still see in the market and what also analysts are looking at, there's still this battle between employee experience goals and cost optimizations.
So it's actually easy. When you look at the facts and you understand the analytics behind the facts, it's actually very straightforward. So I made a comment earlier that before COVID, when you do utilization studies, otherwise known as bums and seats analysis, you know, how many people were sitting in what seats during the day, the average space across North America, based on all the client work we've done, was sitting 50% empty. That was before COVID. And that's because the way people work, we're no longer processing paper from the left to the right of our desk. We're moving around, we're engaging, we're going downstairs to the coffee shop to collaborate with our colleagues. We are in meeting rooms. So we may be at the office, we're just not physically sitting in our seat. So the way that we work has changed in our digital world. And so because of that, you have to physically change the workplace. And what we saw originally came out of Australia and Europe, where many companies were moving to unassigned seating models. And with the unassigned seating model, because people are moving during the day, you have the space that you need just when you need it. So if I need a meeting room, I have it. It's there for me. If I need a private office, I have it. It's there. If I need a touchdown space, collaboration, whatever, I have it. When you move to the unassigned seating model, it unlocks all that empty space you had before. So the accountants get really excited about this, right? Because you can reduce your footprint when you look at it on a cost per employee basis. And so the metrics are very much aligned. You can reduce your footprint, improve your sustainability and ESG goals. You can then focus on your cost per employee, you know, and instead redeploy some of the funds that you were spending. Obviously, the employees are the largest line item on your P&L. So you can reduce the money that you spend on empty office space and then spend the balance of it on, you know, the employee experience. And so that experience includes both the virtual online experience, if you choose to work from home 1 or 2 days a week, having the right technology, whether that's, you know, buying chairs and desks for people at their homes, making sure they've got wireless connectivity as one example. So virtual experience right through to physical in-office experience. And so there's the extreme where you might throw in, you know, ping pong tables, foosball, and all those other things that some companies, typically technology companies, choose to do, right through to the design of dynamic workplaces that I mentioned. If you're moving around the space during the day, you want many different environments. You don't want to sit in your cube and get bored out of your skull all the time. You want to have many different settings. So these new workplaces have 20 to 30 different settings, and that all fosters the employee experience, fosters engagement, and it makes a much better organization and an operating model. So on one hand, you've reduced your cost structure. On the other hand, you've really enhanced your employee experience. So it's a net win for the business. And in that experience, it really helps in the war for talent and engagement, drives productivity and all the other great things that we like to talk about.
From your experience, then, could you tap your hand on like drivers for workplace satisfaction, like that typically help with employee experience?
So when you think about the workplace, it's all about engaging with your colleagues, right? And it's about the excitement of engaging with your colleagues and the intellectual stimulation and the feeling that you're moving forward, moving ahead at its core, and then driving to some greater mission or goal. Especially with 5 different generations in the workplace, everybody coming together to drive toward goal A, B, C, or X, Y, Z that is very meaningful. That's really at its core what we're working toward. So if I'm engaged in the workplace, I'm engaged with my colleagues. And so to foster that engagement, the design of the experience becomes really important. It's not about creating a bunch of cellular offices and workstations that we never get to see each other. It's rather about producing collaborative environments, areas that are provide an opportunity to come together. So these new workplaces will include, coffee areas that or cafe kind of environments for larger organizations. And in the cafe, I might be sitting there doing emails, but then suddenly my colleagues come in and I can bump up against them. We can have a great conversation. And it just changes how we do work. In the old days, you'd go out to a coffee shop and that would take time to get to the coffee shop, to buy your coffee, to do your thing, and then come back again. Now, if they're embedded in the workplace, it becomes much more productive. It's then also about creating many different environments so that I'm delighted as I go through the day. I'm delighted that I get to sit in this collaborative area and we can share a screen and we can work together toward a presentation, or that we might think through an analytical process together in a different setting. So what you're doing is designing the physical environment to then foster that engagement with your colleagues and your clients and other visitors to the office space.
I hear a bit that actually the starting point then is though to know purpose of the company and to make that known among your staff and create that sense of belonging in that community. I think actually it's a good point in time because you've mentioned so much how the workplace should be enticing. I know you've joined remotely, but do you know what the workplace configuration at Avision Young actually is?
Oh, for Avison Young? Absolutely. Yeah. Because we're changing that workplace vision and we're changing what the future of work is, how the worker will engage in the workplace, and then the future of the workplace. And so we're now rolling out our own new program. Obviously, I have a major influence in that activity. And we're scaling that for each market because what we do in LA may or may not be the same as Toronto or Chicago or New York or London, right? So each market might be slightly different. But the principles of the purpose of Avison Young as an enterprise, what is our purpose? Making sure that we have engaging environments powered by people, right? For us, it's all about being powered by people. It's all over our website. So you say, well, what does that mean when you translate that to the physical design? So some of the principles that I've just mentioned are very much part of that. Design engaging environments that make sense for our people to, A, want to come to work, to bring their clients to work, and to engage with their colleagues. Obviously, based on good ESG and wellness standards at the same time.
How do you measure success with that? I mean, oftentimes employee surveys are done, and then you always have a bit of a risk running into survey fatigue at some point. Is there a way to put that into metrics that you can continually retrieve and read from?
Absolutely. So professional services firms are fairly straightforward on how you go about that. So on one hand, you'll measure all the cost metrics, right? That's easy to do. The other hand, you'll manage the revenue experts. So you typically look at revenue per employee or your total revenue and your EBITDA contribution. So that financial metric is pretty standard. Now you get to the next layer and you look at your recruitment. How many people want to come and work with you? At one organization that I worked at, when we did the workplace design transformation, post new workplace, it was so cool and everybody wanted to work there. 99% of the recruits accepted an offer to come and work with us. And the physical workplace was one of the major reasons. Because what the physical workplace can do is it can transform your environment. It can change the conversations that people have with each other, right? Because you're changing it from a cube farm to a wonderful dynamic work environment. And you're saying the engagement between people changes. So recruitment retention, the financial metrics, and then, of course, engagement scores, right? You have to look at engagement scores. So whether you're doing a pulse check on an ongoing basis or whether you're doing some other, type of engagement, a survey metric, those would be some of the more common approaches to how you would look at. In the old days, you'd also measure sick days. Although now, if you're going hybrid, you can still be sick and work from home if you wanted to. So that's another great measurement of engagement and employee productivity. becomes the end metric.
You've accompanied a couple of organizations already on their transition from a fixed seating model to a more flexible one. Do you have typical lessons learned is one part of my question. And the other is, I think in comparison to Europe, there tends to be a bit of, in the US or North America, there's the cubicle form, as you just mentioned, is still very popular somehow. How is that? Or why is that?
Oh, so that's a huge psychological exercise unto itself. Glad I share with you a bit of my journey. So the Australian banks were, I think, the first group to really move to unassigned seating. It was Macquarie Commonwealth National Australia Bank. And what they would do is they would, and so having learned lessons learned from the benchmarks and others, what they did is they created brand new buildings that people would move to unassigned seating in those new buildings. Spectacular architecture. So lesson number one, it has to be spectacular design to be successful. That's my personal bias. If you don't have something exciting to go to, then why bother going? Go find somewhere else to work. So that was lesson one out of that whole experience overall. Lesson number two is look at the value proposition in the workplace. So some of the key considerations. So The Edge in Amsterdam by Deloitte focused heavily on sustainability as an example. And when you think about all of the components of that building, looking at ESG overall, their metrics, you know, blew the socks off globally with respect to what that looked like. So again, purpose of the workplace beyond just the processing of your own work, but contributing to CO2 emissions and so on. So that became a second one, both the spectacular design, then the purpose of the workplace. Now you get into your own existing population of people. We've got five different generations working together. So you think about the more senior folks who are used to, especially if they've risen through the organization, their big ego corner offices, right? That's classic example number one. And you then go say to Bob or Sally, you know that big ego corner office that you've worked your entire career to achieve and it's got all of your degrees and stuff on the wall? Well, you don't need that anymore because we know you're only sitting there 20 to 30% of the time. So therefore, why would you have it? That's really the crux of the change management issue and how to ensure that their individual requirements are met and achieved through this new workplace design. So it's very important to have a thoughtful, methodical change management program because going into this model, people say, no, not me. I need my big ego private office or I need my workstation with all my stuff, whatever it is. You go through the process, you help people through the transition from, you know, 6 or 12 months before through to 6 months after. And you say, here's what it can look like. And you constantly measure and address major issues. Out the tail end, I have stories where many resistant people did not want to go into it. Out the tail end would see the benefits. Look at this, all my people. We come together in a room. We have really exciting conversations. And the magic becomes all those different generations coming together to solve the purpose of the organization or the problem, maybe C or XYZ. And the engagement. So what you give up in your own individual cube, you gain by engaging with your colleagues and employees. And so then making sure that you identify and assess each of those tangible benefits out the tail end. Everything won't be perfect. It's important that when it's not perfect, you measure it and address it immediately as you move through the process. Now we have the pandemic where everybody's working from home. So we're all used to it. You know, and 85% of the people through surveys will say, I want to go back to a hybrid environment. I'd like to go back to work 2, 3, 4 days a week. I'm not sitting tied to my desk 5 days a week from 7 in the morning to 7 at night. I want a hybrid. So now people are very well positioned to take advantage of those new environments.
So do you think then that sooner or later, companies will have to switch for that kind of environment? There's no way they're going to entice anyone to come to the office in the cubicle form.
So what I would say is one size does not fit all. So each company will have its own version of that solution, and there'll be different levels of the adoption curve. So while law firms, for example, or tax accountants might be more resistant, they will still embed some elements of these designs into their new futures. Others, like, you know, consulting firms, might be more ambitious in that area and move entirely to unassigned seating. Many of the Canadian banks and governments are moving to unassigned seating now. So again, it depends, and you scale it for the organization and the market, because market norms are changing at the same time.
That means, though, that currently you don't really know what to go by, because you need to find your own way and own story in the workplace. How should companies then now make decisions and future-proof their workplace strategy?
Well, you know, it's workplace consulting 101. It's always based on the data and the information from that client group. You can't pick a solution for company ABC and apply it to company 234. Like, that won't work. So it's about your process to understand that company and the enterprise based on the facts. So the first one is to understand the business, the strategy, where is it going, what's the culture, what are the values of that organization. The second part is, who are the people, what are the culture, what are their various work styles, do they do heads down work or do they engage with others, are there a lot of clients coming to the office, is it project based, is it, you know, database, what does that look like for that organization? And then the next part is, what are the tools to be productive? And so those tools could be both physical in-office tools or virtual tools. Are they technology platforms, or do you need to have a bunch of smart boards around? What does that look like to be productive? The very last thing is, what is the right environment in your workplace? And I'll say, before, everybody went straight to the workplace and kind of ignored all those other pieces, whereas understanding those pieces becomes everything toward the final solution.
We touched on it before from the landlord side. Sustainability is another big topic on the agenda also for occupiers. And I think a lot of things are sometimes still the green building certification, and then that's it, although you could probably do more. How do you make sure you do that, actually? And what are the things you can easily do in that regards?
So it's about ESG and wellness, right? That's really the opportunity. And so the question becomes, you know, how far do you want to go down that spectrum? So at the core, we talked about the building itself. And so, do you pick only those buildings that meet your ESG standards? And that would include base building LEED, you know, silver, gold, platinum, or net zero. Do you want walkability scores attached to those buildings? Do you want it close to public transit so people can easily get there by transit? And so on and so on. There's many factors that go into your location decision. Once, and if you want a shopping list, I'm happy to share with you that shopping list of things that you would include. The second part is your own physical space. What would you do within your own space to make sure that it is sustainable? So that could include the procurement of materials, you know, furniture, fixtures, and equipment going into it. So the procurement of those materials, making sure that they have, or they've met sustainability standards, as an example. It could include, I talked about footprint. You know, if you want to reduce your footprint, to reduce your challenges with environmental sustainability, you have that opportunity. So any organization, if you're moving from a traditional work environment to these new, you could easily reduce your footprint by 10, 20%, probably before COVID. Now in the new hybrid world, you can probably reduce anywhere from 30 to 50%, again, depending on the organization. Another factor that is considered for some organizations is flex work hours for your employees. If employees aren't traveling during heavy traffic time, rush hour, and they're picking other times, that too can contribute to reduce CO2 emissions. Moving folks to digital work styles, hybrid work environments, so they're not then traveling to their office every day, and maybe they work from home 1 or 2 days a week. That also contributes to reduced CO2 emissions. I've got a shopping list I can get go down through here. But clearly, each one of those elements becomes really important. And then the last big one is around your facility management practices. And typically they have a massive scorecard to make sure that when they operate the facilities themselves, whether it's through production of paper, printing, encouraging electronic transition, for example, digital platforms is one whole big area, removing plastic bottles and containers, looking at your garbage and waste disposal, having wellness centers for your employees. I mentioned the base building staircase to run up and down the staircase, but that's another type of example. And then another would be the food service. If you do offer food service, having sustainable and well food, healthy foods available for your people. So those would be the major categories. I'm sure there's 1,000 others on my list that I could come up with. But again, it's looking at the entire employee and visitor, customer, client, user experience when they come into your space.
Means also that really everyone can take a stake in that. You shouldn't say like, okay, the sustainability department is going to handle that or the ESG council is going to handle that. But you can yourself for sure find something in your area of responsibility. And if it is to make the choice not to print something, so I've printed something, but... In return for that, I'm not running a second monitor, so that maybe balances things off, I'd hope.
Here's a good one for you. So you may print it, but you're now going to shred it when it's done because you don't need to then have a filing cabinet to hold all your paper, right? And think about the filing cabinets around the world holding paper. Like we could fill a gazillion, probably goes to the moon and back like 10 times or whatever the number is. You don't need to do that anymore. We've got digital platforms. We don't need paper. And so you say, let's reduce both the initial printing, but then also the storage of it. Storage is also a big topic. What is it? 40% of the world's CO2 emissions come from buildings in some way, shape, or form. So whatever we can do to reduce that, both the creation of buildings and then making sure that existing buildings have sustainability focus put on them is really crucial.
Yeah, so actually companies revisiting their portfolio size right now and thinking about right-sizing due to remote work options can have a huge contribution to emission goals. So now another thing I wanted to touch upon was that you are a member of the Career Network as well. You've had a long career in commercial real estate, and it's still largely male-dominated. It probably was so even more before. So I'd really love to hear a bit about your journey and what you're doing in the Crew Network, actually.
Sure. So as I started as a young professional female, as you can imagine, there weren't many people like me in the real estate community. My passion for real estate really swept away any, you know, of those negative encounters or issues, whether that was just, and it was as much me, you know, I didn't play hockey. I don't smoke cigars. I don't drink scotch. I'm not 6'2", and I'm really lousy at golf. So all of those things, you know, would say there's a bit of a disadvantage here. So for me personally, it was like, you know, a Nintendo game or something where there was an issue that came up, you just push it down and continue moving on. As I say to the young folks that I mentor, it's all about the tortoise and the hare. I don't know if you know that story, but if you're fast like the hare, you may move very quickly and burn out, whereas a tortoise, slow and steady, runs the ways. And so that's my approach to my career for the most part. Every year I put a goal or accomplishment, I'd want to achieve certain things. And so there's a very methodical way by which you can do that, whether it's a new skill, a new degree or accreditation, a new experience. I happen to love the consulting world, so I'd always find myself in new consulting projects that would challenge. And so I think it speaks to your ability to be tenacious towards your goal or your outcome. That's kind of one whole topic. And the second is your approach to excellence. Nobody cares, you know, what your package is if you're producing excellent work. If you deliver great for your clients or your colleagues, I think that's really the bottom line metric. Now, if you're to say to me today, we're in a bit of a different environment, although very traditional. When we started Toronto Crew, I think it's 30 years ago, one of my former directors said, we don't know how to golf. None of us know how to golf. let's have a golf tournament and we will teach people how to golf. So everybody leans in, okay, we got to figure this out because clearly it's an important part of our industry. We need to understand it. So now the Toronto Crib Golf Tournament is one of the biggest events of the year and it raises more money for charities than anything. Not necessarily great golfers there, but at least we're participating. So rather than shying away from the issue, it's about, you know, Sheryl Sandberg, leaning in and taking control of the issue and the opportunity. The other thing that I would say, the question that's asked of me an awful lot is how do you balance work life, i.e. children, right? That's the biggie. How do you manage that? And I would say to you, you know, 10, 15 years ago when I was having young children at home, really tough because I was gone early in the morning to later at night and this balance wasn't there. Today with these hybrid work styles and models and opportunities, you can still be there and be present, you know, early in the morning, late at night, and work from home during the day, and you have much greater opportunities to be flexible. So take advantage of all that. Bottom line in the whole thing is never let anything get you down, right? The turkeys will always try to take over. You never let that get you down. You continue to be tenacious. At the end of the day, you can vote with your feet. If an organization is not treating you properly or you don't feel you have the opportunity to move forward or progress, vote with your feet and find another opportunity that's more commensurate with your own style and ethic.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You need to find your spot and your passion because from that comes the excellence that you've mentioned. And you've mentioned as well that the hybrid world that we're entering now is a huge opportunity to change things. Do you see, besides that, other areas where this change can have a positive influence?
Well, everywhere. So I'm really lucky. I work at Avis and Young. And, you know, to put a commercial out there for this company, it's about every voice counting as we work toward a solution, a project, or whatever, right from the top. Mark Rose is very actively involved in Crew Network and very actively involved in diversity, equity, and inclusion. We've got huge mandates around that. So I work with a place that values, you know, those items. That's kind of step number one. Step number two, in the workplace, my voice might be very different than a traditional broker, might be very different than our accountant or a lawyer or whoever. The secret sauce in all of this is about bringing all of those voices together, all of those thoughts, and coming up with a solution that actually meets everybody's requirements. You know, you've always heard about it in team building and business school. Well, this is where it plays out in the workplace, where you have many diverse technical skills and demographic contributions that actually make a more robust solution to whatever problem you come up with. So I see it play out that way every single day because I now work in one of those environments. Very positive, very productive for the organization and for the contribution of every employee.
So you seem to be in a very good spot there. If for the rest of the real estate world, you could have a magical wish, what would it be?
That's a giant question.
I know.
What would it be? So I guess the question is, what is the role of real estate in the world? Right. And so in the past, we viewed it as an asset, certainly in our commercial real estate business. It was an asset. It was bricks and mortar. It was, you know, shell and core. It was all of that stuff, all really important. But real estate's an experience. It's about the experience people have in that building, in that community. It's about what we bring to the table. So I think the passion now is about how can we make that a better experience for everybody that's taking place, either the community or ecosystem around the real estate or in the physical building or workplace, whatever, however you define that. I'm on the board for a large Canadian retail company, REIT, and they pay very close attention to what the experience is of people coming into that asset class and that opportunity. And so I think if we pivot from, again, shell and core to experience, that's really the name of the game for the next 20 years for all of us.
I remember, now that you just said it, I remember that when I was in university, one of our professors said, you should never invest your feelings in stone. But I feel actually it shouldn't be like that. We should have feelings when we move into to buildings and enter them. Like you said before, you need to be excited about the workplace to go there, because it's just, if it's just white desks in a white room, why should you go? You need to feel something to feel that connection.
So think about it, you know, and you could eat your meals at home. You could shop from home and have stuff arrive at your door. We all had to live that way during the pandemic lockdown. Everybody's racing now to get out to the restaurants, to go to the shopping malls, to, you know, have the food experience or the engagement experience. We're dying. We're craving to be out, you know, to be together with other people. So how do we make that better as a real estate community? Suddenly restaurants are out on the streets. So streets aren't all about cars going back and forth. It's about the experience. So I would challenge our community to do a lot more of that and to think about the user journey, whatever that journey happens to be. That's going to be everything as we move through the next two decades.
Yeah, absolutely agree. So it's been really great to have you, Sheila. Hope we'll speak soon.
Thanks so much, Spain. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode of The Workplace Leader, there's more. Go visit our blog and have a look at some of the other topics we have covered. Or tune into our next episode of The Workplace Leader.